From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the fight to save the Syrian border town of Kobani from Islamic State militants looks grim. A closer look at the tactics of ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
It's really unprecedented in terms of its capability in all sorts of ways.
Hong Kong pro-democracy demonstrations continue during talks. And Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett bringing jazz to new fans. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Kurdish fighters battling to save the Syrian border town of Kobani from Islamic State militants have told a few thousand remaining civilians to flee, a sign the town may be about to fall. But it is not always easy to cross into Turkey, the only place refugees can go. Jamie Detmer has a story from the Turkish-Syrian border.
Kurdish women refugees from the besieged Syrian border town of Kobani are complaining about the difficulty they had fleeing Islamic State militants and entering Turkey, the only safe place within reach. Turkish border guards at Sorok refused to allow them to cross for 15 days. They finally crossed over late Sunday because the refugees wanted to bring their all-important livestock with them, or their cars, and the Turks would not allow that. One refugee from a village near Kobani says they fled because the Islamic State fighters were shooting at civilians with their tanks and that they burn Kurdish farms and kill anyone they find. There have also been reports of Kurdish women being raped by militants. Much of the border on the Syrian side is now a vast parking lot full of cars and trucks abandoned by the refugees. Some of the men stayed behind to protect their vehicles, and shepherds who are unable to guide their sheep through illegal border crossings or to bribe border guards to allow the livestock in continue to tend their flocks a few hundred metres from the fighting. How long the shepherds will be able to do so remains in doubt. The militants are making progress and clearly have breached the southern part of Kobani's centre following their seizing of a strategic hill on the east side of the town on Monday. Despite a US airstrike on Islamic State positions, the fourth since last week, Islamic State fighters were raining down shells on the town centre. A pillar of smoke could be seen rising close to one of the central mosques in Kobani. And with the Kurdish defenders ordering out remaining civilians, as many as 20,000, in readiness for a final stand, few here believe the remaining Kurd positions in Kobani can hold out for much longer than 48 hours. How many refugees from Kobani and its surrounding villages are now in Turkey is difficult to know. Turkish authorities keep changing their estimates from just over 100,000 to nearly 200,000. What is clear is that the Turkish town of Sorok cannot cope with the influx, and refugees are seeking shelter where they can, from tents supplied by Turkey's emergency agency to shops and even garages. Nevez is a 45-year-old farmer and has three boys and four daughters. The family is sitting in a small square in the centre of the crowded town of Sorok and eating some bread donated by a Qatari charity. He says he left all his animals, land and farm behind. His wife shakes her head and says the family sleeps where they can. They're waiting for a tent. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Sorok.
Islamic State militant actions, such as the beheading of journalists on camera, have been termed brutal acts of terrorism. Max Abrams with Northeastern University is a terrorism expert.
This is an unprecedented group in many ways. We've never actually seen anything quite like this group. As a political scientist, we look at many, many groups, pretty much every known group since the 1960s in order to make predictions about groups today. But because this group is so different, we're not really sure of our predictive abilities. This group is unusual because, on the one hand, it resembles an insurgent group. It's a bit of a proto-state. You know, we laughed when the group declared over the summer that it should be called Islamic State, but in many ways, it is sort of like a state. And that changes the dynamic dramatically because its revenues aren't based on external funding. This is a group that relies on predation of the local population. It taxes, it holds people hostage and demands ransom. And of course, most of the revenue is from oil, from selling crude oil, making multiple millions of dollars a day. And so in that sense, it's more like an insurgent group. But whereas insurgent groups tend to focus their attacks locally, this is an insurgent group that's comprised to a large extent on foreigners. So you have, you know, over 3,000-4,000 Westerners who have joined this group. And so its membership isn't particularly local. It's very international. And that's just from the West. There are other countries which have contributed more than any Western country, like Tunisia, or there are many Chechen fighters. So the composition is very international, and the presumed target selection of the group is also very international. I disagree with those who believe that Islamic State is a local threat. Sure, it's local, but it's also very much international, and so you put all these things together, and we're looking at a very unusual group in the sense that it's an insurgent group with an international composition and international aims, and it's really unprecedented in terms of its capability in all sorts of ways, in terms of its social media, in terms of its revenue, in terms of its weaponry. So we're in a very unusual situation analyzing this group.
Now, this group is also known for very brutal activities. Could you describe some of the things that it has been known to be doing over there?
Sure. I mean, this is an absolutely morally reprehensible group. I think that the most shocking abuses have been towards women. And I would encourage the brave listeners to Google, do a search engine on women in Islamic State. And it's really quite shocking what they do. They are selling these women into slavery, sexual slavery. They're, quote-unquote, marrying them off. They're establishing large brothels that are actually administered by women. They engage in countless beheadings. Some of the beheadings, due to social media, get a lot of attention, like the Foley beheading, Sotloff, Haynes, the Henning beheading. Those are the four beheadings that have gotten the most attention. But this is beheading more generally is an instrument of their coercive behavior, where many people have been beheaded, not just those four, from Iraqi military members to Lebanese to Syrian. And this is a group that is very indiscriminate in its target selection. It has a very narrow view of what is acceptable behavior, acceptable ideologies, sex, faiths, etc. And anybody at all who deviates from this is a potential target. You look at what's going on right now in Kobani, and I'm very worried that Islamic State is going to overrun the Kurds there and massacre the population. So from a moral perspective, this is about as reprehensible as you can get.
Max Abrams of Northeastern University and the Council on Foreign Relations. Tomorrow we ask our terrorism expert, are the ISIS terror tactics working for the militants? The advance of militant Islamic State fighters in Syria to within a few kilometers of the Turkish border is raising concerns the group might attack inside Turkey, a NATO member, possibly requiring a response by the alliance. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
As a NATO member, Turkey is entitled to help from the 27 other allies if it's invaded, and it has already received an anti-missile system and other assistance to shore up its defenses. In his first week on the job, NATO's new Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg confirmed the commitment.
Turkey should know that NATO will be there if there is any spillover, any attacks on Turkey as a consequence of the violence we see in Syria.
But analysts, including Josef Janning of the European Council on Foreign Relations, say NATO will be reluctant to do any more than absolutely necessary to defend Turkey's borders. Janning spoke to VOA via Skype.
Most likely, NATO would be very keen to make sure that alliance solidarity is kept up, but not to give Turkey a carte blanche on military operations into Syria or into Iraq, for that matter. I don't think that many NATO countries would be comfortable to be kind of forced into this conflict through the back door.
Janning says the problem is that the situation in Syria is complex, and NATO nations are concerned, as they have been for years, that any attack on rebel groups like Islamic State will only strengthen Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In addition, he says, after the long, difficult, and costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, NATO nations do not want to be dragged into another insurgent war.
Before NATO could engage in a Syria operation, NATO would have to have an idea of what the outcome would be, what sort of end of conflict situation they would want for Syria. And that's where the problem starts.
So Janning and others expect NATO to tread carefully, even as it lives up to its security guarantee for Turkey. At Carnegie Europe, senior associate Judy Dempsey says any operation to defend Turkey would have to officially be a NATO operation under what's called Article 5 of the NATO Treaty. But she says it might not end up involving all members or a major commitment of land forces.
NATO, as NATO, could invoke Article 5, but what we could get is coalitions of the willing, which is effectively what we're seeing now in the coalition that the U.S. has assembled for this bombing campaign.
Even so, Dempsey says NATO may find it difficult to limit its involvement.
Without boots on the ground, or without coming to some kind of political negotiations, ISIS has a free hand. We've got ill-prepared armies in Iraq. You have Syria in total destruction. And just wait till northern Israel gets unstable. This is so combustible and dangerous.
And that's not likely to change. Islamic State has not retreated in the face of the U.S.-led bombing campaign, and Josef Janning says the threat of NATO involvement will not likely deter the group either.
If NATO gets involved, I don't think that would deter ISIS terrorists much. They may see it as an additional confirmation of their importance and relevance in the region.
The mutual defense commitment is the core of the NATO alliance, and experts say it applies whether a member is under threat from an army or a militant group. They expect a NATO response if Islamic State attacks Turkey, but they cannot say just what that would be or exactly what impact it would have. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Student demonstrators in Hong Kong and the government are to hold talks as pro-democracy demonstrations continue today. Reporter Ivan Broadhead has been out on the streets of Hong Kong, and we asked him about the mood there.
The mood is a lot calmer. I think people are very satisfied that pre-negotiation negotiations are underway. There's a very real sense that the government will be meeting the students at the table sometime later this week. There are various questions about the format of those discussions, but out on the street, I think superficially a lot of people, a lot of reporters in particular, are saying, you know, is the situation winding down? The reality is that for a few days now, the students have been on a shift roster, as it were. So they've asked students to come in on 8-hour shifts. By definition, therefore, it would appear as though there are 2/3 less students in terms of absolute numbers on the streets. Students still remain out in Mong Kok, which has been quite a disputed area, and in Causeway Bay. This afternoon, Felix Jung, who is a member of the Liberal Party, presented a petition to students signed by several dozen shopkeepers and owners asking the students to retreat from Mong Kok and Causeway Bay. And there's a very tangible sense that the protests are harming the economy, but in particular are harming small business owners. And I think it's fair to say that You speak to any shopkeeper and they will say that their sales are down at least 50%, perhaps more in some areas. But generally speaking, the streets are very calm, which is good to see. There's a full moon tonight. There are people joking that bad decisions are made at full moons. But generally, everything is calm on the streets and people are looking forward to getting to the negotiation table.
Now, what do they hope to accomplish with these talks?
Well, that is the key question. I mean, realistically, I think from the outset, Occupy Central, which was run by a gentleman called Benny Tai, a law professor at Hong Kong University, had a very real sense that perhaps the most important thing was to get people out on the streets, because actually securing results or any positive outcome from this situation was going to be very difficult, because ultimately the Hong Kong government is almost powerless to change things. The decision and the process of change, democratic reform in Hong Kong, really very much, well, totally rests with the central government in Beijing, of course. So we potentially could be setting ourselves up for a fall here. There may be no obvious outcome. There may be nothing that satisfies the students. And I think then we need to seriously think about how this movement is going to continue, how it can continue, and what form the protest evolves or adopts after that.
Do you think the Hong Kong government was taken a little aback by the size of these protests initially?
I think that is absolutely fair. I think that there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and vacillating and flip-flopping amongst the original Occupy Central movement. They weren't sure what date they were going to go to the streets. They weren't really sure what demands they needed to make. So I think I need to clarify for listeners around the world, there are three groups who are representing the protesters here. There's the Occupy Central movement, which is essentially comprised of older members of the public and academics and politicians. They were the ones that got the movement underway. And then there's the Hong Kong Federation of Students, which represents the majority of the students. They've been the ones that really have led everybody out onto the streets. I think they got fed up with waiting for Occupy Central to give the nod for everybody to come out and protest. So they really have seized the bull by the horns. And then there's a group called Scholarism, which is made up of high school students, led by Joshua Wong, who's now very well known around the world, a young 17-year-old student leader. And they have taken it upon themselves to look after the social media and the comm side of this protest. So these three groups doing three different jobs. But it really was the Hong Kong Federation of Students that really galvanized everybody to move out onto the streets. They're a very credible organization, and Alex Chow, their leader, is a terrific leader. And I think as a result of his inputs, the government was completely taken by surprise, hence the tear gas incident last Sunday, hence the images that have been generated of protesters really body to body, stretching almost a kilometre across this east-west artery of Hong Kong. If any of your listeners have the chance to look at the drone photographs of the downtown district, they are quite remarkable, and there haven't really been protests that size since the large Tiananmen Square protest back in the early 90s, 1989, 1990, when Tiananmen was still incredibly fresh in people's minds.
Reporter Ivan Broadhead speaking with us today from Hong Kong.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Jazz was born more than a century ago in America's black communities and evolved over the decades into an inclusive form of music, incorporating and enriching the sounds of immigrant cultures and the country's changing society. The U.S. Congress declared jazz a rare and valuable national treasure in 1987. While many rock and soul singers incorporate jazz rhythms and sounds into their music, a pop superstar and one of the legends of jazz and popular music have brought the two worlds together on a new album of duets and solos. Reporter Jeff London spoke with Lady Gaga and legendary crooner Tony Bennett about working together on cheek
to cheek.
You might
think they go together like oil and water or chalk and cheese.
I think it's probably what a lot of people are thinking when they hear Tony Bennett wants to do a jazz album with Lady Gaga, and they say, huh? What are you talking about?
It's not the first time Lady Gaga has recorded with Tony Bennett. The pair collaborated on The Lady is a Tramp for his previous duets album, which won a Grammy.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
I'm starving.
She loves the theater, but she never comes late.
I never bother with people that I hate. That's why this chick is a tramp.
The two decided to team up for a full album of standards. And Bennett says Lady Gaga's up to the challenge.
She's actually a very authentic jazz singer. She'll turn a phrase, she'll make it different because of the moment that she's singing. And so what happens is it keeps the songs alive. The interpretations become very intimate and everlasting.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of to get the feel of life.
Like Bennett, Lady Gaga was born in New York City, and she's actually been singing jazz since she was a kid. But she's, of course, best known for her pop songs and her over-the-top stage shows, which draw sellout crowds around the world. So why did she decide to record with Tony Bennett?
He's brought out a subtlety in me that I've missed for a while because my life is very noisy.
But the new record is not, says New Yorker pop music critic Sasha Frere Jones.
You know, her records have become increasingly sonically so crowded, so noisy, but not with noise, just sort of noisy with information that I don't understand what's going on exactly. And this is a wide open, fairly natural record. I'm sure there's some editing involved in there, but you know, she's there.
The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
I don't know what the world will make of it, but it's actually pretty good.
Frere Jones points out that Lady Gaga is more than pop spectacle. She can really play piano and sing. She says working with the 88-year-old Bennett has been a real education.
I love watching Tony perform. I always sit in the theater and watch when he's performing without me with his quartet.
They say into your early life romance came.
Tony Bennett hopes the learning experience extends to Lady Gaga's audience.
It's the first time that young people that love you so much will fall in love with George Gershwin.
Oh, yeah.
With Cole Porter.
Oh, yeah.
With Irving Berlin.
And most of them, a lot of them, surprisingly, know some of those songs. And they're sort of getting more and more and more excited, and it's becoming cooler for them to talk about who wrote what. Tony's really opening up a whole new generation.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round.
They all laughed when Edison recorded sound. I feel very validated by this. You know, he's given my fans a gift by saying to them that he likes the way I sing jazz.
They also seem to genuinely like each other. They will be on stage singing together in a televised concert in October. And in case any of Lady Gaga's fans are curious about who wrote what, Bennett promises there will be visuals identifying the songwriters at the start of every song. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen to our program or any of our past programs. Just go to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.